Welcome, everyone, to the ACG Women in Gastroenterology podcast, where we spotlight the issues that matter most to women in GI, from fellowship through every stage of a thriving career, from conversations about maternity leave and contract negotiations to navigating post-graduation career paths and optimizing your practice. Each episode offers practical insights designed to leave you informed, empowered, and confident in your journey forward. My name is Anushka Dua. I'm a third-year gastroenterology fellow at the University of California in Irvine and an incoming faculty member there shortly. And now I would like to introduce our guest, Dr. Jamie Kanukin, who is an inflammatory bowel disease specialist and associate professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology since 2021. She currently serves as the clinical practice chair for the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology and associate chair of practice and systems transformation for the Department of Medicine. She's also the director of the IBD intestinal ultrasound program at Mayo Clinic, Florida. In 2025, she took on a role as a medical director for InBasket and for the ambulatory communications subcommittee for Mayo Clinic Plummer Chart. She has been recognized as a fellow of the American College of Gastroenterology and the American Gastroenterological Association and the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. She has spoke locally, regionally, and nationally educating physicians and NPPA on the importance of billing optimization. Welcome, Dr. Kanukin. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, gosh. Thank you for having me. So excited to be here and doing this podcast with you.
Great. And I'm so fortunate to be moderating because this is very timely for me, going to start a faculty position soon, and I'm sure it'll be helpful for so many others. So I'll start with kind of a broad question. Why is understanding billing and coding such an important skill for gastroenterologists, especially early in practice?
Yeah, that's a great question because it's not part of our curriculum, right? But it's like a foundational skill. We get paid in many capacities. Maybe not all institutions work on that type of model, but most people that practice gastroenterology get paid on what they bill. And of course, there's opportunities to inappropriately bill up or down. So it's a foundational skill that can impact how we are valued by the healthcare system. And it's not just for gastroenterologists. This is for any physicians and even non-physician providers. So, you know, most physicians, we spend time mastering all these skills, our clinical medicine skills, our procedural training. And really, I've asked across the country, and I was one of the associate program directors at the University of Michigan, and we didn't have anything in the curriculum. My own fellowship didn't have anything in the curriculum that was taught by a clinical person, right? So you can go and spend time with our coders and our billers, but they're not clinicians. And so they're not doing what you do every day. So sometimes it doesn't always translate very well. But reimbursement, RVU, staffing support, operational resources, how do you garner all those things if you don't understand sort of the business side of medicine? So I do think that early in practice, physicians need to develop documentation and billing habits that will persist for them, right? The worst thing is to learn it the wrong way or not learn at all. Leave fellowship, go into a practice, and this practice assumes that you know how to do this. And then you're maybe underbilling, which is fraudulent, or you're overbilling, which is fraudulent. I think sometimes the misalignment comes from when we talk about the stuff, people think that we're trying to game the system or we're trying to bill more aggressively. It's just actually accurately capturing the complexity of the care that you're providing. Many gastroenterologists, including myself, manage chronic immune-mediated conditions, inflammatory bowel disease, you know, chronic hepatology-type conditions. I don't do that. Chronic pancreatitis, where we work in multidisciplinary care teams, whether that's in academics or in private practice, and we use high-risk medication. If we don't document that complexity, then ultimately that ends up translating into what we are allowed or can accurately bill. So I think it's overall like a broader kind of understanding as we get into practice that we have to understand this aspect. Like you can work all day and see patients and document, but you also have to submit billing and coding to be able to get paid or for your organization to get paid or to garner the resources for your nursing support or your MAA support or your navigator support. And if you are leaving money on the table, then you're potentially missing out on resources to help fund your program. If you're building a new program, you're a new graduate from fellowship and you're tasked with building a service line. You want to ensure that you're capturing the complexity of those patients so that you can get those resources to build that program.
Now, you bring up a great point about, you know, this misconception that exists that you're trying to game the system. It's really just that you're trying to capture what the kind of care that you're actually delivering. I want to ask, why do you think many physicians, maybe even women in particular, might be less likely to engage in this financial side of practice?
Yeah, I think historically, I think our training has reinforced that focusing on finances or reimbursement is somehow a very separate entity than taking care of patients, yeah, or even maybe inappropriate to discuss openly in a forum. And so many, I think, physicians are taught that they view billing as an administrative task as opposed to viewing it as a part of that patient's care journey and the ability to, you know, provide that sustainable, high quality, highly valued care. I do think it does disproportionately affect younger fellows or younger physicians going into practice. But then I also think that there is a disproportionate effect on women, mainly because we were never encouraged to engage in that operational or financial side of the conversations, either because we didn't have leaders in that role when we were going through the process. And of course, now we have amazing female leaders in many roles. And so we are able to see that and maybe engage a little bit differently. But I will tell you, I remember the first person that engaged me, well, there's actually two, a future ASGE president, Dr. Michelle Anderson, who is a colleague at University of Michigan. And everyone knows Dr. Grace Elta. And they were the two women that served as operational role models for me to be able to like want to dive into this further and ask the questions that I think are important. But I think that there are some sort of misconceptions that prioritizing or understanding reimbursement is not putting the needs of the patient first. Yeah. And I think that that's absolutely not true. I think it's that we're recognizing the complexity of care that we're providing to these patients, that our teams are being valued for that care. And I do think that physicians that understand the process of it, and there are lots of resources out there. I have a couple lectures that are been distributed on different platforms online, but also ACG has a great virtual grand rounds where we talk about billing in the capacity of clinic and endo. And I know AGA has resources that are out there. So there are resources that are out there. If you understand the system, you can then advocate better for your staff. You can have opportunities to say, where is there space to do workflow redesign in this practice? You can enhance digital tools. You can capture some of the external vendors and actually make billing easier. If you're not within sort of the Epic system as your electronic health record, there are external vendors that really try to truly, from an AI standpoint, capture that billing. Maybe it garners you the resources to get a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant support. And maybe it allows you to be able to provide improved access for your patients. So I do really think that understanding this side of medicine is very patient-centric.
Yeah, no, that's an amazing point. And I think as a young female, you know, incoming faculty gastroenterologist, these are things I think about. It's like, it almost feels taboo to think about this because you feel like you're betraying patient care by talking about finances, but I think you put it great, and this is really patient centric. What do you think is the single most important aspect to accurate billing?
Hands down, documentation. Yeah. So you could spend an hour with a patient. If you don't document that, you're not accurately billing. You're not capturing that time you spent. If you didn't spend an hour with a patient, but you saw a really complex patient with uncontrolled ulcerative colitis, having side effects related to steroids, prescribing a new immune modifying therapy, needing to do lab monitoring, but you only spent 20 minutes with that patient, which one bills higher? Well, they both actually bill the same. And so if you meet complexity billing, it's almost, you can spend less time. But most of the time, the way I teach people is start with time. If you spent the amount of time that meets that highest billing code, move on. Don't even think about how complex that visit was. The time that you spend in the care of that patient in that single day, not in that single hour, but in that single day. So you woke up in the morning and maybe you pre-chart and you did 10 minutes of pre-charting. Then you sat with the patient for 20 minutes and you were face-to-face with that patient. And then afterwards, you called their insurance company and tried to get authorization urgently for that medication. And then you communicated with your nursing team and sent some communications and maybe even called their referring provider. Every single moment that you spent in the care of that patient's evaluation and management service for that day counts towards your billing. And so, but you have to document that. And so those are the documentation, no matter if it's time or if it's complexity of care, that all needs to be documented so that you can accurately bill for that patient.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. You have to think smarter about how you're documenting these things. And I'm sure some of that comes with experience, but going in with that knowledge is helpful and I think will help all of us. If you had to name the top two or three areas where you feel like gastroenterologists most commonly leave revenue on the table, what would those areas be?
Gosh, so many opportunities. But if I were to pick kind of top ones, I would say that the first major area, and if there are people that are going into practice, if there are early leaders, like people who are running outpatient practices, we do an audit of all of our providers in our practice to ensure not only accuracy of billing, but you also can start to identify the thing that I think most fellows come out of fellowship doing, because either they were misinformed, uninformed, or it's what their faculty did because their faculty was uninformed, is that they leave a visit and they bill everything as a level three. It feels right in the middle, right? It's not too low, but it's not too five. It's not too high. It's not a five. And so I'm not going to raise any eyebrow. It's actually, so underbilling not only financially can impact your practice, but underbilling is actually fraudulent. And so there are implications to not billing accurately. And so many visits when we do audits within our own practice have opportunities to re-educate those providers about how to bill appropriately. And so we can take those level three across the board people and actually have them billing for what the complexity of the care that they did. And there is a difference between what we collect on a level three between what we collect on a level five. We're leaving revenue on the table. We did the work. People are just too nervous to be compensated or valued at what the work that they're doing. So I think that's the most important thing, is to ensure you're not underbilling, but also we don't want to be overbilling too. So we want to be accurately billing for the complexity of the care that we do. And again, if you meet time criteria, you spend 40 minutes for that return visit, not just in the room, but anything you did around that care, move on. Level five, move on. If you spent more than the upper limit on that level five, you can bill modifier codes where you actually can bill more based on time.
Oh, wow.
And so I think that there's leaving money on the table, not accurately billing. I think the second place where there's money left on the table, and some of the work that I've done within our site here at Mayo Clinic, was add-on codes. So whatever level that you did, there's complexity add-on codes for chronic care management. And many people that I've given talks to, you know, across the country in this space don't know about the G2211. So if you are serving as a longitudinal specialty care provider managing chronic high complexity conditions, I'll give you some examples. Inflammatory bowel disease, cirrhosis, Barrett's esophagus, chronic pancreatitis, GI malignancy, the list can go on, DGBI. If a patient is longitudinally in your care, they're not seeing you as a one-time consult, you can bill with the right attestation at the bottom of your note. And that's all easy within the electronic health record, to just pick the template that has the G2211 attestation, which is that you are responsible for the longitudinal care of this patient for their chronic medical condition. There's increased billing associated with that. So you get your level five for the time that you spent, and you get your modifier. And so we're leaving money on the table when we're not using that modifier. And I will tell you, it is the most commonly not used modifier or complexity code add-on in probably all of medicine, but we're talking about gastroenterology. So there's opportunity there, and we've got a campaign pushing for that. I will tell you that my nurse practitioners and my physician assistants are great at this. They are capturing this a lot. I think physicians sometimes are just really hard to retrain that concept of doing something a little bit differently. And capturing that. So that's an opportunity. Those are kind of some clinic evaluation and management services opportunities. The third kind of thing that I would think about is procedural coding and optimization of procedural coding and endoscopy. Common missed opportunities in that. And again, we had a virtual grand rounds on this. Biopsy billing and snare techniques correctly when performed on separate lesions. So we all know that really we should be taking out almost all polyps with snares, right? That's guidance-based, but not possible. A biopsy is okay, but maybe this person has diarrhea and has some polyps. And so you need to do your random samples for microscopic colitis, and you're taking out some polyps. Those are two separate billing and codings, and sometimes people aren't capturing that revenue piece of it. Recognizing when a polyp meets criteria for endoscopic mucosal resection and capturing that and documenting. And again, all of this requires documentation. The nice thing about most of our programs that do our endoscopic reporting, we just went live with the Epic form of endoscopic reporting, Lumens, is that most of these are built in. Like if you click the button, you're going to be able to capture that. But for some of maybe other organizations not using that, or previously using probation, I know that they're including that as well. But It's just ensuring that you are getting accurate documentation and then capturing the right billing code. Capturing hemostasis, or if you do therapeutics like dilation, using different modifier codes based on if you did multiple procedures, if it was for screening. And those, again, are usually built into some of these endoscopic reporting tools. But if people are doing it still more manually, there may be missing opportunities to add some of these codes.
There's also modifier codes for the procedural.
Yeah. And so there's a whole table of things. And so if you're, you know, again, if you were selecting the right button that you did this and you took out this polyp in this way and you met all the criteria for an EMR, it's going to almost auto spit that out. But if you're not using your system that does that, sometimes people are sort of not capturing all the codes that could really help enhance their endoscopic billing. And again, it's not about gaming the system. It's just documenting and capturing the work that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I recall a moment when I was earlier in fellowship and I had no idea what was going on, but I think we had shifted, you know, the procedure reporting software we were using to Provation. And I don't know if that was it or if it was something else, but there was an attending who had been there for a couple of years who I think just in that moment realized that he wasn't documenting the amount of time he spent with moderate sedation. And if you're documenting that time, it's a whole other thing, like something related to billing, but it was something that he was like, I can't believe that haven't been doing this. So clearly it's important for people who are even early in their practice, not just fellows like me who have no idea how to do this yet.
Well, I think in fellowship, sometimes if your faculty doesn't know, then you're maybe being misinstructed at that level. And then I remember when I was a fellow, paper billing was still a thing. And I would go over and watch. I was trying to learn to understand what was happening. Oh, we just saw this patient together. Like, you're filling out this form. I want to see what boxes you're clicking. It was foreign. It was like totally different language. So I said, I'm going to go sit with the coders and I'm going to teach myself this, because there wasn't any sort of curriculum that was available. And I did that. I sat with the coders because I wanted to learn to understand the process. And then since I spent all that time doing that, I developed a talk on billing and coding. And the funny thing is that I developed this talk and then everything changed. All the rules changed. About a year later, they kind of changed the whole billing process, and no longer, you know, it was no longer that it was time just spent in that visit that was face-to-face. It was now any time you spent on the day. And so they actually simplified it significantly, but I taught myself the old way, which meant that when the new guidance came out from CMS, I was able to quickly update the talk and then now go around giving different talks on how billing has changed, because everyone was still, if you knew how to bill, you were still stuck in your old way. And so now we had to convert people to think about it a little bit differently. It's been fairly stable for a while now, at least I forget when the update was, 2021, 2020, at least 5 years, it's been stable. So I think we can feel confident that there was just an update, and AGA had a nice kind of summary of some of the updates that came out that's available on the website, where it just highlighted some of the changes. And really, there were no major changes. It was just really talking about documentation and accuracy of billing and capturing the codes that really were important.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, starting from you being proactive as you were transitioning to your role to giving talks about billing, it's pretty impressive. So that's great. I want to, you know, there's so many things to familiarize yourself with as a late fellow or early career faculty member. But knowing that there's so many things to know, do you have practical tips about how physicians can, or NPPA can, optimize billing without feeling like they're spending all day documenting or coding?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the nice thing, now that we're out of a paper record, and a little plug for a nonprofit that Sarah Horst from Vanderbilt and I started called Gastro Digital Health, which really kind of it's focused on those users that are using Epic, but really is a free resource to learn how to actually interact with your electronic health record as a digital tool that enhances your practice, as opposed to an online version of a paper chart that feels like a barrier. So free resource available to everyone. And the reason why I bring that up is use the electronic health record to help you, right? This is not just opening a Word document and just starting to type and just more is better. It's actually not true. Just because you have more words on the page, just because when you print out the note, it's 15, 20 pages long, does not mean that you can bill more for that. You probably spent a lot of time writing that, which maybe means you can't kind of bill more.
Bill with time.
But that's wasted time. I mean, right? That's time that we are taking away from other things that excite us or that we love to do, or our families or friends. So most modern electronic health records contain tools that can really simplify the process of coding workflow. If you're an Epic user on here, you have a time ticker that is running in the background when you open up that chart. And so it knows, it has a smart ability to know when you are actively engaged in that record, not just that the record is open, but that you are actively engaged in that record. Now, if you stepped away to take a call with the referring provider, it may not capture that unless you're actively engaged in the record. So you have to account for that. But that ticker code is in the background telling you that you just spent 41 minutes. And so you don't have to be like, I think it was 41 minutes, which is much of what we used to do. It has medical decision calculators. So if you don't meet the time, but you're like, gosh, this patient feels more complex than a 20 minute, you know, visit based on time billing, there's calculators that are there, or you can use some of the resources that I've put out. And maybe as part of this podcast, we can link out to one of my updated PDFs so that people can have that as sort of a take-home resource. And then there's external vendors that can do automated coding suggestions. But I think having a template, and whether you agree as a group, if you work in a group of individuals that see similar patients and disease types, so our IBD group, having a similar template, using different forms to be able to capture data, maybe the patient input that data. Patient-reported outcomes are great to inform the HPI. And you don't have to meet certain documentation criteria anymore like you used to 5+ years ago, where you had to document X, Y, and Z in the H&P to be able to bill a certain level. The documentation that is required is the complexity of care that you provided, which has nothing to do with what your HPI looks like. And it has nothing to do with a physical exam. So you can bill a level 5 on a virtual visit with a patient and not physically examine. Many people are unaware of that. And the pandemic really, not a lot of positive things came out of that, but that was one of them, is it allowed us to actually provide virtual care when appropriate and be able to bill appropriately for it. So documentation template. So the things that are required for documentation is your evaluation and management of that patient, your assessment and plan, the amount of time that you spent caring for that patient. If you are billing a G2211 and that attestation that needs to be there. If you're billing on complexity, not on time, and one of those complexity criteria is that you, not for every complexity, but if you use the criteria that you independently reviewed the images, and many of us should already be doing. If our patient has had imaging, we need to open it up. We need to look at it. Mm-hmm. But me opening up and looking at it does not inform my note of that. You have to document that I independently reviewed the images, and this is my impression, to be able to bill that part of the complexity coding. So I think creating templates that either set you up for medical decision-making success and the requirements for that billing, or time-based success, which is just an attestation that you spent X amount of time. So building these things into your electronic health record, your daily workflow, is going to be really important. And I think it's important for new people. So this is a great recommendation for you, is just to ask your billing coding people in the practice, just to do an audit after you start for a month. Have them audit some of your chart and provide you feedback. I will tell you, if you only bill level 5s, you will get audited by your billing coding people because they want to make sure that that's accurate. And I did when I first started, because I do bill level 5s mainly because of the patient types that I see and the amount of time I spend, but also the complexity of the care I'm providing. Mm-hmm. And they audited me and found out that 100% of my billing was accurate. So it's not necessarily, you just have to document that accuracy. They determine that based on the documentation that I had in the chart. So I do think that that's important. And it's also important, not from an overbilling, but it's also important to make sure you're not underbilling too.
Yeah, those are great recommendations. I find myself here taking notes on what you're saying, even though I'm moderating.
Yeah, I love this. So we can, and I think that takeaway resource for our listeners, I think, would be great, of a place that a link that we can put in the podcast to have them go out and be able to have sort of the visualization. I love podcasts, but I'm a visual person. And so I can say all these things, but I need to sometimes see the table. You know what I mean? Right. Like I need to see the image to really comprehend it. So I think that might be a nice takeaway resource.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll definitely request that from you and put that out for our listeners. So we've kind of spoken a lot about how these skills have, you know, financial benefits, but also benefits for patient care. This is a patient-centric thing. But my final question is kind of about how mastering this billing and coding can translate perhaps into career advancement or leadership opportunities.
Understanding the business side of medicine, I think, is the sort of the theme there. And part of that is understanding, you know, the business side of medicine is the money in and the money out. One can't be bigger than the other in the wrong way, right? And so you have to understand, how does the money come in? Well, then you have to understand billing and coding. right? Are you capturing all of that revenue? You've got this group of 30 people that report to you, and you know, you see high complexity care, but the numbers are going down, or you ask your biller coders to look and they say, you know, we could use some opportunity, and we meet as a leadership team on a regular basis to review our financials. And one of the, you know, where the two opportunities are within procedures, a 22 modifier, which our listeners are all over the country. It is very state dependent and payer dependent on what criteria generates a 22 modifier. But what is very clear is that there needs to be documentation to be able to go to an insurance company and put a 22 modifier onto your procedure. 22 modifier translates to you get the procedure reimbursement plus you get more. So it's taking that procedure that you're already getting reimbursed for, but capturing the things that happened and identifying the payer and getting paid more for that procedure. So that is a major opportunity where it doesn't mean that we're working harder. How do we work the same but capture the revenue, right? We have to be smarter in making sure that we're actually documenting and billing appropriately. Same thing from clinic. How do I capture on my clinical operations leadership hat? How do I capture more revenue from my clinical team without making them see more patients, right? And it's to make sure that we have accurate document and billing throughout. And there is always opportunity to improve that. And I gave you some kind of ideas as to where that could happen. So I think that's important to understand the business side, because healthcare operations is overall, if you want to go into the sort of the administrative side of medicine, even if you are a researcher and want to be a division leader, you can't rely on your non-clinical administrative partner to be the only one in the room that understands this stuff, right? Because then how do you ask the thoughtful questions? Because they're not clinical. And they're finance driven, and they're so much smarter than me when it comes to that. But I'm the clinical person that understands a little bit about the finance side. And so I'm able to ask some questions that are more clinically focused in a meeting that may help us consider different opportunities to either capture more revenue without making people work harder. Yeah. So I think that's really where it translates into career advancement. If you're looking to be on the sort of administrative side of medicine,
you're great. You're kind of like the clinical liaison between, you know, it's health
operations administrators. Yeah. And then your clinicians. And it's not about making people work harder. And that's sort of the tagline that we have for Gastro Digital Health, which is I want to make the EHR work smarter for you. I want you to be able to go home sooner. I want you to use this as a tool that enhances care and not see it as a mountain to overcome. And it's possible. I just think that we all developed really strong negative relationships with our electronic health records when they first came out. And those have persisted. And I think some people have PTSD when it comes to the in-basket and then the pandemic and all the things that happened. And so it's really about trying to help people just, you know, the system is here and we have tools that can enhance care that actually can help us take better care of patients, can help us better document and document accurately so that we can capture more revenue and we can get the resources that we need to more efficiently run our programs. So I do think, and so this sort of, again, this was accidental. I was never interested in this. I came to become interested because I knew I needed knowledge. I didn't feel like I was getting that resource when I was in training. And so I sort of had the billing coding people teach me. And then I took what they said and then I made it clinical. Because if you've ever listened to even me, I listen to those talks from a billing coding person that is not a clinician. And I'm like, I know a lot about this stuff and I'm confused.
Yeah.
So whenever you need that.
Yeah, absolutely. You can provide those real world examples. I remember having a discussion as an early fellow about billing and coding. And I remember completely zoning out because I felt like I couldn't understand what was going on. It didn't feel clinically relevant. So you're right. Like, we need leaders like you who are in the space of giving of, you know, clinical care for patients who actually know about this.
I think it's so well said. I think physicians who understand the clinical and the operational sides of medicine are the ones that are probably the best equipped to take on some of those leadership roles in whatever capacity that is. Because again, even I'm not, you know, my main hat I wear is not research, but I do research. And the clinical side, how we run the clinical practice and the revenue that we have from that drive the resources that we have to drive research and innovation and how we're going to really shape how we deliver care in the future. But, you know, as one of my first administrative partners had said, she said, we have to keep the lights on, right? Like, and so we can't provide innovative care. We can't see the patients we want to see. We can't do the research on the patients that we want to see. We can't do endoscopy unless we understand how to appropriately capture the sort of business side of medicine. And it differs in academics and in private practice. There are different drivers and different ways that you can capture revenue. So this is really meant to be more broad kind of guidance. But I do think that there are some nuances, and maybe we do another podcast where we have like private practice versus academic and some of the ways to kind of the nuances and capturing that business side of medicine and gastroenterology.
This has been really great. Thank you so much for joining us and providing this insight. I think this is going to be extremely useful for late fellows, early career faculty. Shout out to Gastro Digital Health. Shout out to G2211. And thanks, Dr. Kanukin, for your time today. It's been extremely helpful, and we'll certainly try and release these resources however we can after this podcast. But thank you again for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.